Every so often, I start reading a book and find myself so immersed in the story that I cannot stop reading it. That was certainly the case with Rachel Cochran's debut novel, The Gulf. It's a literary thriller set in a small Texas town named Parson during the 1970s. The protagonist is a very complicated young queer woman named Louisa. Lou is in the process of renovating an old mansion for her elderly neighbor, Miss Kate. One day, Miss Kate is found dead in her backyard, and her daughter Joanna returns to town after being away for many years. Joanna is Lou's first love. As the gripping story evolves and secrets unravel, Lou learns the truth about how Miss Kate died and who killed her. The inspiration for The Gulf came from Rachel's own experiences growing up on the Gulf Coast of Texas. She joins us now to tell us why she wanted to write this novel in the Southern Gothic style.
Gothic is slippery because it's a genre that kind of seeks, you know, to enter other genre spaces. So you'll hear about Gothic horror, you'll hear about, you know, Gothic crime. Sometimes Gothic means supernatural, sometimes it's more domestic Gothic with maybe a sprinkle of supernatural. Southern Gothic uniquely is not just about hauntings or about the transgression of the unnatural or the uncanny into the natural space, but it's specifically about the American South and the violences that it committed and that it's really built on, displacement obviously of indigenous peoples and of course slavery and its legacies. And the ways that continues to haunt life in the South now. So you have writers, again, like Toni Morrison in Beloved, or like Jessamyn Ward in Sing, Unburied Sing, who really directly metaphorize what those legacies are in the form of ghosts. But in the Gulf, I consider the Gulf a Southern Gothic because the ghosts are both kind of internal and external. They do things that are just ever so slightly unexplainable, but almost all of it has to do with the psychologies of the characters and their own individual experiences of guilt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. The Gulf is set in the town of Parson, Texas, but there is no such town as Parson, is there?
No, there's not. It's actually quite difficult to find the name of a town in Texas that isn't already the name of a town in Texas. I very deliberately wanted to create a new non-real place.
Right. So because of the fact that allowed you to kind of creative carte blanche in terms of what you wrote about the town?
Yes, it allows creative carte blanche. It also allows amalgamation. So instead of just being a place that has a real history, I have to adhere to that specific and perhaps exclusive. I was able to kind of bring in a lot of what I knew about the entire region of Texas and allow a lot of these real experiences that are scattered to kind of coalesce into this one place. So it's not just a town that has a plantation history, but it's also a town that has a textile factory history. So we can bring in that kind of labor exploitation into the town's sort of historical violences as well.
Hmm. The story is told from the point of view of your protagonist, Louisa Lou Ward. Can you tell us about her?
Lou is... she's tough. She's sort of a queer lady who kind of is a handyman, and she's a little kind of snarky, and she can sort of take care of herself in a way that I think I really admire, particularly as a queer woman, closeted, of course, but you know, clearly incredibly out of step with what her community's expectations about her gender and gender performance should be. So very visibly sort of other and outsider, which could make her a victim of potential violence. And we see in the book that she does receive, you know, violence in different forms because of who and how she is. But she is kind of not fearless, but she's able to sort of step up into that space of owning herself in a time that really wishes she wouldn't. Right now, she, you know, at the beginning of the book, she is tending bar at this place called Buck's that used to be the rowdiest bar in town, but there's been a storm that hit her town And everyone else seems to be fleeing Parson in the aftermath. There's no real reason to rebuild because the storm did so much damage. But Lou is very stubborn and she clings to Parson. She doesn't want to leave. It's the only sense of home that she's ever had or ever known. So she's a little stuck in the past, a little sort of drawn back into those moments from her youth that the book sort of deals with.
Mm-hmm. And she had to keep her home life completely separate and hidden from the outside world. Why?
Her reasons are complex, and some of them are external, real reasons actually coming from her community, and then some of them have to do with her own sense of stuckness and guilt. But for practical purposes, she and her brother end up living with their aunt by marriage, who is Mexican-American. And this is in their childhood, which is in the 1940s and 50s. So segregation is very, very real in this town. And if there was a whiff or a sense that these kids whose, you know, parentage cannot be fully established in any kind of legal sense because they kind of grew up in this, very paperwork-free kind of childhood with a mother who struggled with addiction before she abandoned them. So if their parentage can't be established, if the community begins to suspect they're anything other than white, then they won't be plugged into, you know, the privileges of Granbury High, Granbury School, which is the, you know, quote unquote good school, the well-funded school, which could give them opportunities to maybe improve themselves and their lives. So their only real mother is Aunt Cece, but they have to kind of keep that fact and Aunt Cece herself and her identity and her community a secret from all of their school friends and anyone official in the town. So it kind of leads Lou and her brother to have this double life and really to just honestly be pretty brutal in unintentional and often very silent, but no less painful ways to their aunt who has gone so far out of her way to care for them and to be a mother to them.
Yeah. After 15 years away, Joanna Kerrigan returns to Parson. And while Joanna and Lou were best friends back in the day, there is a lot of tension between them now. Why?
Lou blames Joanna for basically everything that has gone wrong in her life since Joanna left suddenly, right at the beginning of the school year, their freshman year of high school. And there are some reasons Lou blames Joanna that are fair and that follow a kind of logic. And then there are others that feel like obsessively, tempestuously an extension of Lou's kind of more stubborn, more self-isolated, self-obsessed kind of side of her personality. But basically Lou's logic is that Joanna turned Lou and Robbie in, Robbie, her brother, that she told the big secret about Aunt Cece and made the community suddenly aware of and questioning of Lou and Robbie's parentage. So they ended up actually being moved to the other school, the school with fewer resources. And Lou sort of blames Joanna for the fact that her brother ended up still stuck in this town when the Vietnam draft came calling, and he eventually lost his life in Vietnam. So Lou kind of draws, you know, a tenuous connection between Joanna's betrayal when they were children to her brother's death in Vietnam many years later.
I'm curious about how you kept track of all your characters and what they're doing in the present and the past. Did you kind of Homeland Claire Danes style it with a detective board filled with index cards, photos, news clippings, and strings running amok from one pushpin to another?
I am an obsessive outliner, and I use spreadsheets on my computer to outline the book. So I would have a page that was chapter by chapter beats, and then I would have another page that would follow a certain character's trajectory sort of as those chapters went along. But yeah, there's a lot of moving pieces in the book, and it took a lot of obsessive planning and careful sort of x-raying of the novel as I went along and as I went back through for revision to make sure everyone's sort of on the right tracks throughout.
Mm-hmm. Did you know what was going to happen in the book before you started writing it?
I did. I don't always, whenever I sit down to write a story or a long form story, but in this case, as I mentioned earlier, I had read a lot of Tana French, a lot of Kate Atkinson. I was reading a lot of these more literary mysteries where the thing that happens is more about unlocking a person's truth than it is about any big kind of fireworks or sort of, you know, Fast and Furious style action sequences as the book comes to its close. Because I think one of the most dramatic things that we do in our real lives is we learn new information about people we thought we knew. And that new information, that new perspective totally changes our world, and it can rock us more deeply than any external event ever could. I started with the end. I started with the last couple of things that happen. And I asked myself, what book do I need to write in order for those moments to have the biggest possible impact for this character as she experiences this? And I kind of retrofitted the entire story around that question.
I occasionally thought of Shirley Jackson's novel, We Have Always Lived in the Castle, and the Bette Davis movie, Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. Were they influences in any way?
You know, I had never seen the Bette Davis movie, but one of my very first readers made that connection after he read the book. I still haven't watched it. I'm hoping maybe, you know, as a little celebratory moment, a little later in the release process, I'll sit back with some popcorn and watch it. But I've seen stills, and I can absolutely see sort of how the setting or milieu connects to the Gulf. But you are dead on the money with We Have Always Lived in the Castle. I had just taught The Haunting of Hill House in that mystery and Gothic class that I was teaching just before I wrote the book. And was reading as much, you know, I adore We Have Always Lived in the Castle. I adore the sort of dusty stagnation of its setting and the sense that you live within the reality that you create for yourself, and how a voice, and particularly a first person voice, can recreate that reality and those limitations for a reader and can get in and get out quite quickly doing so. I find Mary Cat in that book to be one of the most compelling narrators in fiction. And that was definitely an influence.
Yeah. One of my favorite things, I have so many favorite things about your novel that we don't have time to talk about them all. But one of the things I noticed, especially early on when I was reading, is the flow of your sentences. There were a lot of details in each sentence, yet it didn't take long to read them. And, you know, I was eager to absorb that sentence, but then was also eager to read the next sentence. Can you tell me a bit about how you construct your sentences?
Sure. I try actually to think as little about it as I can, but I sort of come to fiction writing. My first love was songwriting. I played piano and I would write music. And I think there's something about that. It's so much less strictly metrical than poetry, you know, often can be, because the way you sing it breathes different life into it and brings different approaches. Often when you read the lyrics to your favorite song, they feel a little kind of dead on the page in a way that they certainly aren't when someone is singing them. And some of my favorite musical artists and songwriters, like someone like Kate Bush, whom I adore, her lyrics seem often like a very bizarre fever dream that like kind of thunks when you just read them, but then she sings them and there's this strangeness and the strange beauty to it. And I think, you know, prose can have more effect on the pace of how quickly or how propulsive a sentence feels and how it flows into the next sentence and creates those sort of like gasps of pause or of momentum, then we sometimes give it credit for as writers. And I think coming at writing prose from a songwriting background, you know, just as an enthusiasm and a hobby, made me aware of that and really into it. And now I try to get that, all of that I just said, totally out of my head when I sit down to write, because it can be more instinctive. You know, the more I think about it, sometimes the more it kind of turns to crumbs on the page rather than something that actually has flow in it.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. Especially, yeah, Kate Bush, that once you mentioned that, I can see the connection, especially in terms of describing her lyrics as a fever dream. And, you know, in many ways, the Gulf is very much like a fever dream. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. What is next for you?
For me, I mean, I can't get away from the Gothic, and I can't get away from communities of women and sort of representations of communities of women. So I have actually, you know, three novel projects that I'm really happily working on at different stages right now, but all of them are in some way, you know, they have a crime or a mystery at the core of them. They're very gothic in terms of their tone and their intentionality and their relationship to the past and questions of legacy and violence and haunting. But specifically, one that I'm working on right now is set in a late 19th century finishing school. So it's asking this question of when you're in the very high class world that finishing schools are relevant to, what does it mean for girlhood to be finished into womanhood? What skills, what values, what beliefs are being instilled? And what does that installation process look like? What rituals are involved in there? And the more I started writing in this milieu, the more I realized, oh, this is just a cult. And I was reminded of the term, the cult of domesticity. So the novel sort of asked the question, what if the cult of domesticity were literally a cult with cultish indoctrination practices? So I've been studying cults, I've been studying finishing schools, I've been studying, you know, the late 19th century as a setting, and writing, you know, this mystery, gothic mystery that takes place in this context.
Mm. Rachel Cochran, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on The Gulf. It's hard to believe that it's your debut novel. I look forward to the next three novels.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about it.
Rachel Cochran is the author of the superlative Southern Gothic novel, The Gulf. Find out more about Rachel and The Gulf at wpr.org/beta.
I really do use pop culture as like a way of learning more about myself.
Coming up, NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour co-host Aisha Harris talks about her debut essay collection, Wannabe, Reckonings with the Pop Culture That Shapes Me. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.